How many of y'all have heard of Reynolds Price? Anyone? Do you have? You read anything before?
I actually haven't.
Okay. But you heard of it?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll start off by telling you a little bit about Reynolds Price, and then I'll go into a little bit about what we think grace might mean, and then what Reynolds Price might think grace means, and then we'll read together a poem at the very end, but the text we'll primarily focus on is A Whole New Life, which is his time, the few years when he was diagnosed with cancer that eventually bound him to a wheelchair for the rest of his life, and how grace fit into that picture. But this really won't be me talking at you. It'll be more of a discussion and a close reading of some of that text. And hopefully you'll share some of your experiences too. So I'll start off by telling you a little bit about Price. And I'll use kind of a memoriam that I wrote for the Los Angeles Review of Books a couple weeks ago on the third anniversary of his death. The idea came to me when I was talking to the Reverend Robert Johnson, who was used to be chaplain at Cornell and chaplain at University of North Carolina for a long time. He was a friend of Alden, and he's a friend of Reynolds Price. And he told me that he once overheard someone ask Reynolds Price, "What church do you belong to?" And Price responded, "I belong to the church of getting through time." And Price chronicled his graceful getting through in several memoirs, most notably A Whole New Life, subtitled An Illness and a Healing, and that's what we'll be reading from later. And in this, he covers the discovery of his paralyzing cancer in 1984 and the symptoms, surgeries, and struggles that followed. He was a faithful member of his church until he succumbed to the complications of a heart attack one Thursday afternoon about 3 years ago. Price thought, however, that the tumor snaked around his spine might be the one to excommunicate him from his church. He said, "I've survived, though with paralyzed legs, from the tumor that gave every sign of killing me when it was discovered." He wrote this to a reader and a fellow cancer patient. And then he said, "The means of my survival worked outward from a sense of God's awareness of my ordeal and his willingness to watch and to brace me, generally in deep silence, in my own fierce hope to live." He wrote this in a letter, as I said, to a fellow reader and a fellow cancer patient, and the letter ended up being a book-length response, and he later published this in a book called Letter to a Man in the Fire, Does God Exist and Does He Care? Only a few months after the initial discovery of his cancer in 1984, the New Yorker published the first poem for Price that it would publish out of the three that they eventually would. So on December 24th, 1984, they published a poem that had to deal with Christmas Eve, perhaps between two lovers, and it's called Recall on the Strangers, and I'll read from it now. Christmas Eve afternoon in the hot toy, plaza, beer, me learning, Lucidus. You coaching me lines, we apparently invisible, no passer, woman or child can see us. Dinner on the cliff by the suicide curve, tropical lobster, all tail. Men's room with a ripped off basin, trembling on its pipes, vast sight of the sea, calm lid on the bottom of the monstrous world, outrageous stars. Our first midnight mass since Vatican II. In the glum beige church, swarmed, solid, steady jolts, no syllable of Latin, dignified slab altar hung, in carcinogenic colors, whiskered ladies at ease in chancel, machine gunning dialect scripture, grim as death lists. A summit, when a prepubescent boy and girl advance in white, kneel, embed the shocking pink child in actual straw as a man in azure leisure. Suit squats to a flip, a loud switch, red, lights wink, antiphonal relays on the stable roof. We think it's over now, our eyes think sleep. Our neighbors in the crush, men with horn farmer necks, spread barrel arms and seize us. You laugh, we're mugged. dry kisses at our ears, then standoff faces again, quarter smiles, intermittent tan teeth, their hard-won salutations spent on tall, pale strangers. Well, we bear its health back and sustain it 3 days. The narrator of the poem and his or her partner begin their afternoon in the plaza, beer. You coaching me lines, we apparently invisible, no passer, woman or child, concedes us. Price's reference to one of John Milton's well-known poems in the opening stanza remains not so invisible because he offered a class on Milton at Duke University, where he taught for more than 40 years before his death in January 2011. This poem by Milton first appeared in a collection of poems that the Englishman wrote to lament his Cambridge classmate Edward King, who drowned when his ship sank. That poem goes, "The air was calm, and on the level brine, sleek Penelope with all her sisters played. It was that fatal and perfidious bark, built in the eclipse and rigged with curses dark, that sunk so low that sacred head of thine." Bark here is a small ship, and the eclipse refers to the notion that a ship built during eclipse might be imagined to be either cursed with bad luck or simply ill-built as a result. So here Milton weaves water, pastoral, song, flower, and body part imagery into his elegy for his friend King. Another King to some who also walked on the waves like King in this poem, Price wrote his own three Gospels in a book called The Three Gospels. Price's narrator in his poem jumps from drinking beer in a plaza to eating lobsters in a restaurant with a wrecked restroom, to celebrating midnight mass in the presence of a blinking light nativity scene, to bear hugs from neighborly farmers, all in 37 lines. Milton's had 193 lines, but like Price's poem, a divine cohesion emerges from the reading experience. One Milton scholar says, "For the dozen or 15 minutes it takes to read this poem, a reader's mind effortlessly finds order in chaos and takes sense from nonsense. The poem's an enabling action for the human mind that empowers us to move, albeit in baby steps, towards the superhuman capacity that would allow us to comprehend death as well." Price's poem here presents chaotic baby steps, and he uses an actual baby along the way, toward a superhuman capacity to not understand death, but birth between the bottom of the monstrous world and the outrageous stars. He portrays this birth as a renewal of health after a long day between partners in this post-Vatican II period of the mid to late 1960s. And Price himself learned of the birth of a darker being a few months prior to his publishing this poem. One might see his images of the sea, and he says, grim as death list, to describe what Price called the eel, which was his malignant tumor that eventually left him confined to a wheelchair. And towards the end of this session, we'll read from his poem, The Eel. Price mentions the specific time of the year being Advent in another poem called Rescue. And he published this in 1981. And it's weird because this is 3 years prior to the discovery of his cancer. And it kind of has a sense of premonition in it. He manages to create images not only of this season of waiting, but of Milton's elegy after King's drowning in the ocean depths, the sea creature that brought his own death, and the paralysis that the cancer along his back would later cause. Here it is. "Something I never told you, I watched, hardly blinking. Each moment of the morning you were nearly drowned or taken by moray, shark, barracuda as you tested yourself in the half-mile channel between our room and Advent Island." He plays with Advent here as both the name of an island in Panama and the name given to the weeks leading up to the scrub of evergreens raided at Christmas that he mentions a few lines before. Later in the poem, Price writes, "You managed to haul your legs aboard." His narrator never speaks of that paralyzed witness of your capture by the sea, its release or abandonment of what it had left you. So Milton tells us back in that original poem that the sea left nothing for King after his capture. It initially left something for Price. In December 1984, a creature from those depths had managed to grab hold to only his legs by the time he released that poem in the New Yorker. I called Price's niece around Christmas this year and asked if she had anything to say about Christmas that year, and she just responded, "I think the best source of information about Christmas 1984 is from Reynolds himself." And the narrator of his poem, like Reynolds himself, in his first months of embracing his diagnosis, think that he can no longer get through time. He quotes in that original, or he says in that original poem, "We think it's over now, our eyes think sleep, but the barrel arms of men wake the narrator and his partner with hugs. Dry kisses and quarter smiles, like Price's own fierce hope to live under God's watch." Price would attend his church of getting through time for another 26 years after he published this poem, but the sea too ultimately left him nothing on January 20th, 3 years ago. The waves left us Price's poem, though, and a reminder that one way to get through time is hard-won salutation spent on tall, pale, and not-so-pale strangers. So this is an essay that I wrote for, like I said, the Los Angeles Review of Books on the anniversary of his death this year. It gives you just a little bit of background of Price and how he was a professor at Duke, a fiction writer, a friend of Auden, Eudora Welty, and was very influential in those type circles. And it gave you an introduction of what his work, A Whole New Life, is about. So we'll switch gears now and talk about what grace means to us. We heard from Ashley just a few minutes ago of the definition of grace. That can be your definition. You can have a different definition of grace. You might not even have a definition. You might just have an experience. Would anyone like to say what they think grace is, or what grace means to them, or how they've seen grace over the years? Don't be scared. Or does anyone want to say what Ashley said?
Yeah. I have something of a story, I guess.
Okay.
But I went to college in Charlottesville, Virginia, left for 2 years, and then came back 2 years later, and had done like a lot of illegal parking in Charlottesville during my college days, and then having a Kentucky license plate, which is where I'm from, I kind of just never paid them. And then when I went back to Charlottesville and started working, my car was parked legally, like on the street. And next thing I know, someone came into the office and said, like, "They're towing your car right now." And after like all of the going through the tow truck, talking to the tow guys, they said, "Unless you pay this like $600 fine of..." Just because time had gone on and like the payment had accrued, I guess. You can't get your car back. And the minister at our church was like, "That really sucks." And they went and got my car. He went and paid my parking like violations, and it had nothing to do with him. It had nothing to do with the church. And but just what it did to me was what spoke the most, you know, what communicated the most was just the sort of, you know, unexpected gratitude that came from, which I think Ashley had spoken of a little bit. That's something I always come back to.
That's a good one. I think the tying Ashley's definition and your story is that, like, you didn't deserve that at all. I like to go to one way I like to break down grace, because it's a big word, is turn to John Wesley's kind of sermon on grace, and he breaks it down into three things. And the first one, I've heard it pronounced two ways, prevenient or prevenient grace, is the grace that comes to us before we even know God. So here, God takes the initiative. And even while we're yet sinners separated from Him, His grace was already active in all of us. And you can really, the best example of this are extremely young children. Obviously, they've already received God's grace and they don't even know about it yet. The second one that he talks about is justifying grace. And this is what he says is the decisive change in the human heart that occurs under the prompting of grace and guidance of the Holy Spirit. And in this particular type of grace, understanding sin is essential to it. And we can think of sin kind of as missing the mark, is what Wesley says. And so grace means that even in spite of our missing the mark, we're made one with God. And then the third one is sanctifying grace. And this is kind of the continuous purifying and cleansing process that we undergo as disciples of Jesus throughout our entire life. This is ongoing, dynamic, and Wesley uses a house metaphor to explain these three, not levels, but just different types of grace. He says, the prevenient grace is the porch of the house, an entryway that invites us to come further. Justifying grace is the door into the house. We must open it and come inside if we are truly able to experience and know the whole house. And then sanctifying grace is learning to live in and grow in the house. So on those three types of grace, what type of grace did Ethan experience in his story? Let's turn to your package. Let's see what Reynolds Price has to say about grace. The first excerpt that I have is from A Serious Way of Wondering. It's a short book on what he thinks are the ethical teachings of Jesus. So we'll start on 120, and can I get a volunteer reader? Okay. Can you just read from the middle of 120, the Apostles' Creed, just to the bottom of that page?
Sure. The Apostles' Creed asserts that, after his death, Jesus descended into hell, a clause now omitted by some Protestant churches. And that assertion has more than one scriptural grounding, chiefly the claim of 1 Peter 3:18. That he went after his death and made proclamation to the spirits in prison who once were disobedient, when the patience of God kept waiting in the days of Noah. If we're to assume that the claim represents an effort by the early Jesus sect to explore the mystery of the 30-odd hours of Jesus' death and entombment, and there are scattered hints throughout the New Testament of some such journey during Jesus' death, then we may even now fairly speculate that the risen Jesus knew more than he'd previously known of such matters as the soul's destination and its condition in the afterlife. And he saw no cause to warn those who met him, risen and glorified, of flames and agonies.
Thanks. Have most of you heard about this descent into hell? Does it surprise anyone that Jesus perhaps went into hell? Okay. Now let's, I guess, see what Reynolds Price, how he relates this to grace. Can I get another reader?
All right.
Okay. Just the first paragraph of 121.
Whatever he learned in the hours of darkness, the ethical barrenness of Jesus' resurrection sayings seemed to me to establish beyond doubt that he had at last come to see the glory of the law with binding force upon us in the law of grace. And grace is the enlightenment, the strength, and often more revealingly, through terribly the trials which God sends us in the hope that we'll more adequately arise to the work of loving our neighbors as our neighbors ourselves, the remainder of creation, and Him.
Thanks. So, Price's definition of grace, or the law of grace. Though terribly, the trials which God sends us in the hope that will more adequately rise to the work of loving our neighbors and ourselves and creation. Which of the three of John Wesley's grace definitions do you think this fits under?
Sanctifying.
Does everybody think sanctifying?
Mm-hmm.
Can someone talk about how Ethan's story fits into Reynolds Price's definition of grace? Did Ethan experience a trial?
Mm-hmm.
That's $600, right?
Yeah.
And that hopefully that once he saw that his debts were paid, that made Ethan think more about how he could rise to the occasion when an opportunity presents him.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody else think differently or have any other feelings about this definition of grace? Okay. We'll move to one more passage in this book. If you'll turn to page 132.
I actually have a thought about it.
Yeah, again. Sure.
It seems like the way that he's writing right here, like he says, grace is the enlightenment and strength God sends us in the hope that we'll more adequately rise. It seems like there's still a little bit of the, like God is giving us grace for a purpose,
mm-hmm.
that like there's still... that purpose is still wrapped up in how we will act once we get that grace.
Right, so it's not automatic.
Yeah, it doesn't seem quite as automatic as like some of the ways that people talk here about like grace being just on its own, like that's the purpose.
Right. That's a good point, that what Price is saying here might not jive with other types of grace that we normally hear. Yeah, I like that. So God is hoping that we'll do it, but we won't necessarily do it. But is the grace that God is sending, is that automatic?
I guess that's the question. The second part of that definition, God sends us grace in the hope that we'll rise to the occasion.
So we'll do something with it.
That will, yeah, like that seems like that's getting really close to being like conditional.
Well, is it God always sends us grace and then we might be able to do something with it? Or is that grace, is that first thing conditional?
Yeah.
You could interpret this either way. Does anybody else have any thoughts on that?
I think about it a little bit differently. Gifts of grace, first of all, they're not on demand.
Right.
They come when they come and they sometimes don't come. So what is the effect on the person?
Mm-hmm.
And I think to a great extent it softens the person's attitude towards his entire environment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It lets him overlook offenses.
Mm-hmm.
It lets him hear compliments. It lets the person be a more genuine interlocutor
mm-hmm.
with his world. So to me that's...
Yeah, I like that. And I think that goes along with loving the remainder of creation. Once we,
but it really, really alters. It's y'all know the word annealment.
Mm-hmm.
It alters your cellular structure in the way you think about whatever you encounter.
I like that. What's that mean, annealment?
It's a scientific word that comes from heating of steel,
mm-hmm.
and when steel is heated, it changes the cellular structure of steel, which
mm.
strengthens it as a material.
Mm.
So if you take that conceptually
mm-hmm.
and you apply that to your internal sensitivities,
mm-hmm.
it's annealing your perspectives.
Mm.
So playing off of all those things that you just said, like the idea which he puts forth here, grace is enlightenment, strength, and trials. all three things.
Sure.
So, I mean, our language, we see the word grace, we think, good, soft, kindness, look. But actually, like you said, with the fire and sort of the empathy for your environment, people, situations, you're kinder, you're more patient, because maybe they just went through some horrible thing that perhaps you now have sensitivity to because you went through some horrible thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of, you know, God sends us, I think, through all three of those things because he loves us as one we love, hoping in his love and patience that we'll eventually rise.
Mm-hmm.
And
I like
love
that.
Like he loves.
I like that because that means that grace can even come in the form of a trial. Because
like
that trial, right, because that trial will ultimately make us love perhaps our neighbor who went through that same trial better.
Absolutely.
I understand. Actually, I have a little anecdote I can add to you.
Yeah,
I was in school at Charlottesville too. And I was in architecture school, and architecture students are always snatching a moment here or there, so we park a car here or there. And the meter maids at UVA are just like fierce. They're like wild boars. So every year the architecture school had an evening of skits that the students prepared. So a friend and I teamed up, and he was the meter maid, and I was driving my old car. And we did a parody about exactly what he did. I caught it. So,
yeah.
My experience lets me understand more what Ethan's talking
yeah,
about.
Right.
Annealing.
That's good. Okay, well, let's see how Price now takes what his law of grace is and kind of applies it to who we are. Can I get someone to read on page 132?
Sure.
Okay, just the, the last full paragraph of 132.
What would Jesus do or think before and after an act or a speech at any number of imaginable moments that continue to plague the curiosities and actions of millions of human beings? More precisely and more usefully for many, what would Jesus have done with any such dilemmas in his own time and place? And of what use might such speculations be for us now? Narrative leaps prepared by serious reading at comprehending both the mind of Jesus and the world that surrounded him, might instruct any one of us, whatever our station or the range of our beliefs, doubts, or outright rejections. The prime conveyors of his meaning to posterity, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are above all storytellers.
Thanks. And can I get someone for the next paragraph? Thanks.
Though Paul and perhaps a few other New Testament authors wrote down their arguments and exhortations earlier than the evangelists, surely the memory of Jesus would have survived only as a footnote in the history of Christian religions if the gospel stories had not been recorded as stories and kept intact for our attention. A man went here and did that. Then he went there and did another thing. Valuable as the quantity of sayings preserved in Matthew, Luke, and John continues to be its mark with his utter faith in story and the narrative faith he taught to others, who lit the hearts of the later Jesus sect and spread its initially quiet flame beyond the Eastern Roman Empire and onward for good and evil into the world.
Thank you. So, Reynolds Price is saying that it's the stories that matter and that we remember here. Does anyone see how that relates to our discussion so far?
Well, why particularly Mark and his utter faith in story as opposed to the others?
I think he says that because, one, it's a commonly held belief that Mark was written first.
Mm-hmm.
And that Luke and Matthew, some scholars believe, based their narratives off of Mark and added, took away. And there's a lot more, some scholars believe there's a lot more compassion on the part of Jesus when it comes to Mark's narrative. So I think those are some of the reasons.
But also Mark
He's not giving a lot of speeches and a lot of sermons. It's very terse. It's just,
right.
You know, just moving it.
Right. We don't get the Beatitudes.
Exactly. More like a journalist. Yeah.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Right. So Price here is emphasizing that it's that these specific Gospels exist as stories that matter. This makes me think that, you know, maybe y'all were just shy, but at the beginning when I asked, what is your definition of grace, or what did actually say grace was? There wasn't a lot of talk. But once Ethan shared his story, I guarantee you all of us are going to remember that story when we think about grace now. I mean, I am. You don't think about his $600 parking ticket. And so it's what Price is emphasizing here is that it's really stories that make us remember things, including grace.
Is he saying that, like, when we think about the question, like, what would Jesus do?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, and Kreiger had all those cartoons of, like, Jesus in these awkward positions that, like, you know, sometimes we think about Jesus in, you know, in random scenarios, but...
Right. That's just our guessing, really.
Yeah, is he saying, like, we're guessing by way of the stories, because anything else is just, like, conjecture. Like,
right.
We can look into, like, first century Palestine or whatever, but these stories are what we're given
right.
to work with.
Right. Yeah, we're not knowing what Jesus would do if the toilets are overflowing.
Yeah.
All we have are these stories, and these stories are the ones that convey the meanings. Sorry, go ahead.
And like with his story, I mean, the value of the story is it's St. Ignatius that tries to encourage people to read biblical story and insert yourself into the story.
And the spiritual, examine the spiritual exercises, yes.
Yeah, so, you know, think of a time when I rightfully owed something.
Yeah,
I did
yeah.
something wrong and
right.
somebody
right.
came in and took care of it.
Yeah.
Right, no, that's good. I like that.
It's like, doctrine
and illustrated. Mm-hmm.
You know, the stories
help
emphasize doctrine.
Mm-hmm. Apply
it
in action. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. That's good. Okay. Well, so now that we've seen a little bit about what Price says about grace, let's read a little bit about his story. From A Whole New Life, as I mentioned earlier, he wrote this about the 4 years of his diagnosis and how he learned to live in this new life. Just to get us a better sense of what the book is about, can someone just read the first paragraph on page 6, Roman numeral 6 to the reader? No one read that?
Sure.
Okay. Sorry, 7, you're right. Yeah. 7, sorry. Can't read my Roman numerals. Go ahead, Ethan.
This is a book about the midlife collision with cancer and paralysis, a collision I've survived for 10 years and counting. It means to be an accurate and readable account of a frightening, painful time that ended. But while I know that any account of human realities will travel best in the form of a story, a compelling story is not my first aim. That aim is to give, in the midst of an honest narrative, a true record of the visible and invisible ways in which one fairly normal creature entered a trial, not of his choosing, and emerge after a long 4 years on a new life, a life that's almost wholly changed from the old. The record is offered first to others in physical or psychic trials of their own, to their families and other helpers, and then to the curious reader who waits for his or her own devastation. Not that I think I have special wisdom, or that all my experience may prove useful for others in similar trouble, I assuredly don't. At best, I'm a companionable voice that's lasted beyond all rational expectation. My ongoing life, then, may be a fact that others can lean on in their own ways, however briefly. In my worst times, I'd have given a lot to hear from veterans of the kind of ordeal I was trapped in.
Thanks.
I've also...
You can go continue. We're going to read the next one, too.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. I've also worked to show not only the weight of the ordeal, but the luck I found right through it in friends and kin, in medical care, though with daunting exceptions. In my two kinds of work, and in the now appalling, now astonishing, grace of God. The human care, at least, was so steady that I understand how numerous others in worse straits may read this as the story of an insulated man in a skirmish.
Thanks. So, in that first paragraph, we see his mentioning a trial, which is one of the three ways of grace that he mentioned in his other book. And we also see his wanting to tell a story, an honest story, but for others. So this goes back to going through a trial that will ultimately allow him to better associate and not sympathize, but empathize with others. And then he explicitly mentions grace towards the end there. Let's start to look at how his identity is changing now as his cancer is discovered. On page 53, actually, I'll just go ahead and read the first paragraph. Still, I had no thought of returning to my novel. I could barely make myself enter the study, and the sight of my computer was literally repellent. Even serious reading, my indispensable companion for years, continued to try my impatience tolerate. Something in me was still deeply jangled, was focused intently on more urgent chores and makeshift pastimes. And despite the swarms of offered food and company from dozens of free-handed acquaintances, I was now avoiding visits from anyone but calm, close kin, and proven friends who'd ask me few questions, give no predictions, and make no demands. To some acquaintances, my closing down seemed thankless of me. So we begin to see certainly an identity change here, where he's been writing nonstop for years, most of his life. His computer now makes him ill. And you see a little bit of despair, too, at the end. Can someone read the last paragraph on that page for me?
I'll read it.
Thanks.
But with all the morbidity of such parlor games, some vital impulse spares my needing to reiterate the world's most frequent and pointless question in the face of disaster. Why? Why me? I never asked it. The only answer is, of course, why not? And a lifetime's exposure to the rocky luck of my large family had inoculated me against the need to make any equally frequent claim that my fate was unfair or unjust. Aware of the troubles of so many likable kinsmen around me in childhood and youth, I'd almost never expected fairness.
Thank you. So how many of us would ask why not in this situation? Did you add what you call a $600 fine?
No.
Why not?
No.
Yeah.
I mean, this is almost my story.
You mind sharing?
Well, I had cancer.
Okay.
And I went into screening a little bit.
And you found yourself asking why not?
Yeah. Because, I mean, in some ways, I guess I asked that because I saw other people who, when I eventually started to interact with them, find such strength in me by just seeing me, not being a wreck or not being angry or not being bitter, being very, very hopeful about it. And that was all grace. Wow. I was like, this is an amazing journey. I mean, as amazing a journey as that I've been on, becoming a Christian at age 30, getting cancer at age 46 was, like, even more amazing.
So you can really identify with this grace via trial.
Yeah, I'm so amazed that I'm in this room. I didn't know what this guy went through.
I'm glad you are.
So, wow.
Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
Does someone want to read the next paragraph?
Thank you.
Thank you.
I likewise never shared the romantic indulgence of discredit with Ivan Karamazov, who declares himself unable to yield to a God who demands or condones human suffering. For my pained but hilarious and magnanimous parents, I had half understood that a normal life is sacrificial and is lived in good part, as in their case, for the sake of others or somehow for the unknown. This patch of fate I was treading now surely felt like sacrifice, though I often wondered for whom or what. In prayer, I even occasionally tried to offer my trials and substitute for certain others whom I valued and in serious pain of their own, but a victim needs to be braver than I to take much comfort from you. That thin gruel, thin and mysterious, you'll never know if your pain is credited to another's account.
Yeah, so we see more of this grace through trial to make, as you said, others stronger. Anybody else have any thoughts on this?
John referenced it in that most recent talk, but I was interviewing this Lutheran minister, mm-hmm. and I asked her if I had heard that she said this somewhere and asked her about it, but she basically said she was in a conference much like this, and someone raised their hand and asked, like, so what do you do to get closer to God? Because, like, I've really wanted to get closer to God, and do you have any tips? And her response was, closer to God? Why the hell would I want to do that? And her experience has been that any time God's been close in her life, it's been a deconstructive, like, trial. That whenever God is close, it's a stripping away, mm-hmm. like something's being ripped from her that she's holding on to for her identity, mm-hmm. And so I just think about that with this, and then that so often you think of grace as this fluffy kind of it's all good, man, you know, like no worries. And, of course, people need to be consoled that way, but also it seems like grace comes with a wrecking ball. You know?
Mm-hmm. I think you're spot on in that we're, a lot of times, maybe most of the time, we end up being closest to God in our trials.
Right. And
Wyman's mind right at this comes right to mind.
Yeah, yeah.
You have the coming to Jesus moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's like he's the only one who could be there with you sometimes. You mm-hmm. know, you're in such deep suffering and so alone, and nobody can walk certain places with you.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you're like, oh yeah, you walked even worse places, didn't you?
Right.
And it's almost like there's this fellowship of suffering, but with Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of makes you feel like, I mean, like he says, so many people have so much worse. And you find that it just helps you. But for the grace of God, there go I. You know, I could, you know, you could be better, or you could be worse, or you could be something. But because you have a relationship with Jesus, even those terrible, horrible events that happen in your life are somehow not that bad.
Mm-hmm. That reminds me, going back to the story theme, a good friend of mine, who I try to do this more often, but he has this thing that if someone is very rude or just mean to him or just irks him, he tells himself a story in the head of why that person's acting like that. So, say he used to be a high school teacher, and say an angry parent calls him one day or something like that, and he thinks this person's ridiculous. And before responding in probably an unkind way, he'll tell himself the story of, you know, maybe this parent's brother just died, and I don't even know, and this is why they're kind of acting like this. And so what I got from your comment now is that if we can tell ourselves these stories, wow, some people have it much worse off than I do, that it can help us too. So it really just goes back to the power of the story and helping us through these times,
and requires you to get outside of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, if your whole life is really kind of focused on how the world impacts you, then you never see another person's story or another person's connection or another person's suffering. Mm-hmm. It's just all, like, one of the stories, and I think about this too. So I heard this, maybe this will, you'll carry with you. So there's a guy on a subway, and there's obviously a parent, and then a couple of small children that belong to that parent, but they're just going bananas. They're just all over the place, really disruptive, really annoying, and everybody's like, oh my God, will police just control your children? And so eventually, this guy says, sir, could you please control your children? He's like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm just not even noticing, because we just came from the hospital, their mother just died. I just don't know what to do. You know, and so he was unable to address the kids. The kids were just kids trying to figure it out.
Yeah, yeah.
And there were these onlookers just getting all uppity because he was disrupting their world.
Right.
Kind of thing, you know?
No, that's exactly right. Well, let's look now a little bit more about how Price's identity has changed. Let's go to page 172, please. Actually, 171, my apologies. And does someone mind reading, starting at the very last paragraph, Forced to Move? Does someone mind starting there?
I'll read it.
Okay, and then when you get to the next page, you can skip the block quote and just continue.
Forced to move by the height of a seated man, I likewise met full on a brutally multiplied population of the dazed and homeless. Upright as I'd been for 5 decades, I'd been able to share King Lear's neglect of the raw bone human misery that huddles beneath us. Reduced to its eye level now as the homeless lay and crouched on sidewalks and meeting their fuming gaze as a standing walker seldom does, I comprehended more than before Lear's insight on the storm-swept heap.
And if you'll just go to the next paragraph and then finish it.
With all that newness, still the full week was a last confirmation that after 4 subterranean years, I'd really come through to the other side of my old life and was certified now as a new thing. Certified by a city that shows a minimal mercy by the friends I'd gone without for 4 long years. A new man who nonetheless bore enough likeness to their former friend to permit resumption of dialogue.
Thank you. So, what do we think about this? We've seen Reynolds Price go through this trial. And this trial has made him view others in a different light. And it's now completely changed him. But is it only the fact that he's confined to a wheelchair and sometimes his computer or to write makes him sick? Is that the only change that he's gone through? No? What other changes has he gone through, Laura?
Oh, well, the isolation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's kind of like someone who's gone off to war, and then the only one of their group who has gone off to war, seen things, and then comes back, and then the same person is, well, they're a completely different person coming back to the same country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's depicted over and over again in movies. You know, so many things that are so important to other people seem very trivial in light of certain other things that some people experience, you know.
That's right. I mean, he says he's certified now as a new thing. This, meaning this trial and this grace via trial has completely changed him. Meaning, I think that's a form of the justifying grace that Wesley speaks of. And it's in the larger picture, it's also a form of the sanctifying grace, the ongoing grace that we're experiencing through our entire life.
Like the middle.
Mm-hmm. Annealing.
Mm-hmm.
We have 2 more minutes.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah, definitely.
Did Wesley influence Christ? Is that why you're using his framework or his model of grace? Or is there a reason, just because you're seeing it in there?
There's several reasons. Actually, I didn't see it until I happened to pull up Wesley's grace. One reason is that Price's mother was a Methodist. And his father was, sometimes he identifies his father as Baptist, other times non-denominational, but his mother's presence as a Methodist was very strong when he was young in Macon, North Carolina. And later in life, there's interviews where Price, for various reasons, including just dissatisfaction with churches that he had been to, he was also a gay man, and I think he experienced a little bit of hurt from the churches. And so he never attended church, but from the time that he was paralyzed to the end of his life, he had an Episcopal priest deliver the Eucharist at his house to him. I think there's a significant Methodist influence in there. There's also the fact that I think John Wesley has one of the best sermons on grace, and that's why I brought it in too. But that's a good question. Thanks. We'll read one more selection, and then we can get some final thoughts. Does anyone want to read the first paragraph of 184 for me? Thanks.
You said the first paragraph?
Yes, sir.
The kindest thing anyone could have done for me once I finished 5 weeks of radiation would have been to look at me square in the eye and say this clearly. Reynold Price is dead. Who will you be now? Who can you be, and how can you get there double time? Cruel and unusable... unusable as it might have sounded in the wake of trauma, I think its truth would have snagged deep in me and won my attention eventually, far sooner than I imagined to find it myself. Yet to this day, with all the kindness done for me, no one has so much as hinted that news in my direction, and I've yet to meet another day's person who's heard it when it was needed most. Come back to life, whoever you'll be. Only you can do it.
What do y'all think about that?
Oh my gosh, I call myself Laura 2.0.
Wow. And you've never read this book?
No, I mean, I did that when I was going through all the scrubbing, the internal scrubbing, the ego and stuff. I mean, I think that happens over and over in people's lives, you know. They're, like, if you become married, you know, you're united to another person. If you become a parent, you know, it's like, you become a new thing, you know, if you become a Christian, if you're not.
Mm-hmm.
So I think an illness, a serious illness like that, it changes your perspective and your value system. And, you know, Paul's all talks all about it in the opening of Panopticon.
I think it's interesting to think about how grace killed the personal price.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That Reynolds Price is now dead because of the grace he received via that trial.
Does he feel he's more because of it? I mean,
I knew him. No, I don't know. I mean, I'm grateful for him that we have writings like this. We wouldn't have gotten this writing had it not been for his trial. You wouldn't have experienced this similar experience had it not been for his trial and your trial.
Mm-hmm.
So I think all of those fit under the banner of grace.
Right. I mean, just think, where would he be if Jesus hadn't died on the cross?
That's very true.
If he got off and, you know, that whole movie, The Last Temptation, got off the cross and was just married.
We could redo this whole conversation based on suffering rather than grace if we wanted to.
Yeah, yeah.
Does anybody else have any final thoughts? Well, it's that time. Thank y'all for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hopefully you enjoy some Reynolds Price and go and read some more of his works.
Yeah.